I want to welcome all of you to this workshop on how remarkable women lead. And as I thought about it, I cannot help but reflect on all the remarkable women we've already heard here today. So I think this is just the most appropriately named topic for a session that I could possibly come up with. And I'm so glad that you've all joined us today. I'm Joanne Rafiel. I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief External Affairs Officer for PPL Corporation, which is headquartered in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I'm very pleased to be your moderator for this session, and I'm delighted by this wonderful turnout. PPL is committed to diversity, and I am so very proud of all the fine women from our company who have joined us here today. We have more than 80 people here, and I see so many friends and colleagues, and I'm delighted that you're here. Our discussion today is going to explore some of the following questions. What drives and sustains successful women leaders? Are feminine leadership traits suited for our fast-changing, competitive, and increasingly complex world? Are there practical tips that we can apply following this session in our professional and personal lives? And helping to answer some of these questions, using concepts from her best-selling book, How Remarkable Women Lead, The Breakthrough Model for Work and Life, is Joanna Barsh.
Hi.
I hope that you received a copy of Joanna's book as you entered here today, which was signed from Joanna in a remarkable feat of quick signing prior to this event. It was truly, truly an act to behold. And we are pleased at PPL to provide this complimentary copy to you. I would also like to mention at this time that Joanna has a second book, Centered Leadership, which is available, and Joanna's going to be talking about this book throughout her remarks today. Joanna is the Director Emeritus at McKinsey & Company, and she is the founder of the Centered Leadership Project at McKinsey. With over 30 years of experience in the consulting industry, Joanna has spoken at the Fortune Most Powerful Women events, Deutsche Bank's Women on Wall Street. She has delivered keynotes and seminars at companies such as Google, Microsoft.
They needed it. Had to.
No, please continue. Morgan Stanley, Novartis, and Walmart. Her groundbreaking research on women in leadership anchored the Wall Street Journal's Women in the Economy Task Force. A strong advocate for women, Joanna is a New York City commissioner on women's issues and a trustee of Sesame Workshop. In addition, she is a member of the International Council of Women's Business Leadership, where she serves on the subcommittee on leadership. Joanna is no stranger to Philadelphia either, I learned. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Pennsylvania. Yay! And then she furthered her education at the University of Chicago and went on to the Harvard Business School, where she received her MBA. So, Joanna, thank you very much for being here with us today. So let's get started. How did you get started with this concept of centered leadership, and where did that come from?
You know, it all goes back to when I turned 50, and I can see that I'm the oldest woman in this room. I'll tell you that I woke up one day and I realized that I had everything I had wanted to have. I have two absolutely beautiful daughters. I was married to the same man, still am. I live in a beautiful apartment in New York. I loved my job. And I woke up and I said, so why? Why do I feel so empty? And as I thought about it over the week, I realized that I also felt invisible. Invisible at my company, invisible in the world. And so I went to my husband, David. And David is an Israeli. I hope I'm not offending anybody, but maybe I will. He's a mathematician. He's a know-it-all. And he said to me, Joe, you're just going through menopause. Why don't you buy yourself a pair of shoes? So I did. And the feeling actually came back. And yes, you know what I did. I bought the second pair, and it didn't work. And so David and I went for a walk, and he said, you know, you got to do something about this. And I thought, I'm clearly missing something in my life. I want to be a leader, and I'm not a leader. But I know how to interview people. And if I went around the world and interviewed successful women leaders, I would understand what I was missing. And that's started the whole thing, because David being David said, Joe, you have to create something that's important enough for men to think it's important. So give it a really big name. And I said, let's call it the Blair Witch Project, which has great brand recognition. And I agreed that that would not be exactly what we were looking for. So we came up with the Centered Leadership Project, which is what it is.
So what exactly is the Centered Leadership Project? Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, thank you. I interview right now about 170 people, mainly women, but also men. And I started to look for and realize that these women were just glowing with power. Not power the way you think about power, you know, somebody raising a big weapon and frightening everybody around them. Power meaning being fully alive, feeling resilient and able to cope with anything that happened, able to lead a sea of people the way I see you all now in a very amazing light. I began to fill up with what I was learning. The first thing that happened to me was I fell in love with everybody I interviewed. And as I thought about it, I said, these people have flaws. These are not perfect people. These are not perfect women. But I love them. How come I don't love myself? I have flaws, and I don't like my own flaws, and I don't want to have them. That was the first thing. The second thing that happened to me is that I learned that it wasn't that I was missing anything. It was that it was all in me. It's all in you. And we just have closed doors. We're either afraid to go there, or we just don't even realize it's there. And that was the beginning of my journey. And what I discovered was that there are five capabilities that take a leader from being good to great. And women bring this. Women bring it. And the leaders that we have today are mostly men. So we don't see this game. The game that women play, not all women, not all of you, but by and large, most of us are different. And that's why I started with meaning. We'll talk about framing how you see the world and the willingness to shift, connecting, the ability to connect, which women bring, engaging, feeling like an owner, and having the courage to take that forward. And then finally, energizing, because women bring this tremendous positive energy into the workplace. When I found those five things, I talked to a guy named Warren Bennis, who's passed away, but he's the father of leadership in academia. And he said, Joanna, why five things? I mean, I am the father of leadership. And I found 23 things. He really. So I'm curious, how'd you get them? And it was a creative process. What could I tell him? I mean, being McKinsey, I tried to tell him, you know, we did a lot of analysis and all that other stuff. Actually, these are the five minimum requirements. You could do a lot more than these five, but you don't need to. If you do these five, not only will you feel blessed, but you will have extraordinary impact in the world.
Well, before we talk in greater depth about those five characteristics, what did you learn through your research about women versus men?
And there's a lot of debate, by the way, if there are any differences between women and men. Of course, we all know that there are extraordinary differences, like we can have babies. I don't know why people had to research that, but nonetheless, in our brains, just to be very, very clear, we're all on bell curves, women and men. And frankly, the difference between women and men is smaller than the difference between women. or the difference within men. The range is so wide. So you can find men who you would say that man has the soul of a woman, and you can find women and you'd say that woman is a warrior in a dress. And that's okay, because we're all actually here to do good. So what I did find deep, deep down is that what women want is different than what men want. So women, by and large, the research would show you, want to find meaning at work. Women want to bring emotion into work. It's not that women are more emotional than men. We're not. We don't know that to be true. But women express emotion more easily, are tapped into it more easily, both positive and negative. Positive being love at work. And I don't mean love affair. I mean just loving what you do, loving being alive, and fear. Women make connections happen. Women build community. And the research shows that when women are there, men feel better as well. We exude oxytocin, which is the hormone of good feeling, and that everybody can have it. Women also, we found, participate in decision-making differently. Men, as my husband would say, yeah, well, I'll make the decision. I love this man, by the way, David. Just in case you're wondering, oh, my God, what's going to happen after this session? I'm going to call him up and tell him I love him, actually. Dave would say men can make decisions by themselves. We've been trained that we have to be smart enough, manly enough, etc. Women can make decisions, but women ask for everybody. What's your input? I'm not an expert. What do you think? So women are constantly getting others to participate. And in terms of energy, this is one, sadly, where men are better. Have you ever felt truly, truly drained at work, but you're locked and loaded? Because there's a problem, and you say, it's up to me to fix it. I'm just not going to eat. I'm not going to see my family. I'm not going to do anything until I fix this problem because it's on my shoulders. Men say, you know what? I'll be at the bar because my favorite game is on, and I'll be back in a couple hours to see how you're doing. So energy comes from men, but we need it more because those of us who take care of others, and many of us do, whether it's elders or partners or our children or our animals, we women just need a lot of energy. So I added that in.
Wow. Okay, so getting to the five characteristics, which I think you already touched upon, a lot of research has been done about the importance of meaning at work. And I'd be interested in what your definition of that is and what you believe about that.
People talk about passion. And I used to think at the beginning of my research in 2004 that it was all about passion. But in fact, a lot of young women were coming up to me and saying, I don't know what my passion is. My daughter, Gabby, would say, my passion is for designer jeans. What can I do with that? Nothing, you know? $160 a pop, you know? So actually, we start with strength. So our definition says that every one of you has extraordinary and unique strengths, not skills. If you go back to when you were a child, a small child, and you remember and put yourself in the moment of the activity that truly brought you energy, your strengths are there. If you think about yourself as a teenager or a college student, maybe some of you are, and you think about the activity that is so exciting that you lose track of time, your strength is there. And if you're at work, an entrepreneur working for a company like PPL, and you think about the last 18 months and a high point for you where there was so much going on and you felt effortless, you were creating impact. Your strengths were there. And so the trick is to think about what is it about those activities that you value, that matter to you, and what is it about yourself in that moment that you most value? That is your strength. So to me, that's the core of meaning. When you know your strengths, then you live into your purpose. You can't just say, okay, it's Friday at 5, I'm going to have a glass of wine, and then I'm going to figure out my purpose, and I'll start tomorrow. It took me 50-something years to figure it out. Some of you knew it when you were 5, and all of us get it in our own time. But if you live by your strengths, and you look at strength in others, why then your purpose will creep up on you, and you will be passionate, even though you've never thought about it for a moment.
Okay, thank you. Now, you also mentioned framing. What exactly do you mean by that, framing?
I love framing, because I'm scared of everything. Even throughout my career, even like yesterday, coming down here thinking it's going to rain so much, I won't be able to get, I mean, it's just, I make it up. Framing is about the lens we use to see the world. You think you see the world realistically. You don't. None of us do. So framing is to get outside of yourself, see yourself in your own movie, and say what's going on. And start to get curious about what that lens is, and be willing to shift. That's reframing. Very, very interesting to think about a meeting or a situation at home where you're totally upset. You completely lost it. Hopefully you didn't hit the other person, but maybe you cried, or you were angry, or you thought you were going to throw up, you were so upset. That's being triggered. And the ability to step outside of it and say, what's going on for you? That helps you to shift. Say, what do I really want to create here? That took me 5 years to work on, and I ultimately got rid of my fear of bullies.
You have an example in your book about framing that really brought it home for me. Do you want to talk about that, the people leaving the meeting that you've been called into? That, after I read that, I understood what you meant by framing and reframing.
Well, we make up stories right in our heads. My favorite one, I don't know if this is one you're thinking about, Joanne, but this was just horrific. Anybody here do supply chain for a living or know about manufacturing? Okay, so you will feel my pain. I was doing a consulting bid, a negotiation, on a supply chain project for a big retailer, and I had 9 guys on my team, all of whom were supply chain experts. I'm a retail expert. But I felt really kind of fraudulent. And we're in this room with 30 clients, all of whom were listening to us for 90 minutes, and then they were going to hear from our competitor right after a 10-minute bio break. Lights are pouring down. We're underground, which is not a great place to present anything. And lights pouring on this table. And I thought, this is not going to go well. 89 minutes into this thing, this fellow, bully, we call him John just to protect his innocence. John says, I have a question for Joanna, and then a question for Jeff, my colleague. And I thought, this is it. It's happening. Hadn't said anything yet, but I kind of knew it was the 89th minute, and my brain stopped working. Literally, I went into freeze before the man said another word. He said, when you said in the second minute of this meeting, I thought, what did I say? He said that supply chain could be a strategic competitive advantage. I thought, I don't even know what a strategic competitive advantage is. How could I have said that? He says, what did you mean? I literally was frozen, and everybody thought, this is interesting. What is she going to say now? And this is what happened to me. You know what this is? Downward spiral. Down. And for women, it works differently than for men. And this is, of course, not true of all women and not true of all men. But what happens is, when the amygdala triggers this hijack, which is what we're talking about, suddenly all the bad things that you have in your memory glom together. So it circles like this. Wow, I can't think of anything to say. And then the little voice in my head says, you're not saying anything. Can't you think of something to say? Stupid? So then I realize he thinks I'm stupid. And then I realize I am stupid. And then I realize they're going to get me fired from McKinsey. And I don't know why my very next thought is my husband doesn't love me anymore. And I remember that I yelled at my children that morning, I'm a horrible mother. That's what I was thinking about. And that's
That's when I said the stupidest thing I've ever said in my entire McKinsey career. Supply chain ladies, I literally said, in a squeaky voice, if you don't put product on the shelf, customers can't buy it. Not my finest moment. That's framing, and I needed reframing, which is what I spent 5 years learning how to do, which is to drill down into yourself, to truly get curious about what's driving what you do. And when you get way down to the bottom of the iceberg, that is you, then coming up the other side, as you realize, I have a choice. I don't have to think this about myself. I can shift. I can choose to see that man as someone who truly cares about his company and is worried. And when I do, I shift how I behave. Because then I say, John, you must be worried. What makes you say that? And I, of course, knew why he said it. I just couldn't, it took me 5 years to realize that I knew it, which was that he was worried that I was just going to take his watch and tell him what time it was, as people worry with consultants, right? We're going to spend a lot of money here. I want to know that you're going to deliver impact, and you don't seem to know. Guess what I did? I fired myself. I literally took myself off my own team because I had my worst fear come true by my own doing, and that's why we need reframing. Sorry to have taken so long.
No, I think it was a very colorful example.
That's why we're black.
So let's move on. Let's move on to connecting. And do you see connecting as the same thing as networking, what we're doing here, or how does it differ?
I actually don't. Connecting is about trust. I'm a shy person. You probably don't think I am, but I actually am a very shy person, and I think half the group here is very shy. And so we don't connect well in a networking situation with 8,000 people, even when they're all women. That's a scary thing. But if you actually shift and think about trust, trust has four elements. So think of somebody you really don't trust at all, and why you don't trust this person. Either she does not deliver, she makes a promise, and then she lets you down. Or I should say, she says one thing and behaves in a completely different way. So then you say, not to be trusted. Or she's constantly criticizing everybody to you, and you can't help but think that she's probably criticizing you behind your back. And or you don't know where you stand with her. She's opaque in her intention. When you have those four elements, think about yourself. How do I inspire others to trust me more? At work? At home? And do I trust myself? How do I treat myself? And that's when I learned that almost all women actually have to work on acceptance, because we have been raised to be perfect. It is part of our biological imperative to find someone and have children. Many of us don't want to have children, and that's okay. But we're biologically driven to try to be perfect so that others will like us. And then we'll be safe, and we'll raise children, and we'll save the world. When we do that to ourselves, by the way, we do it to everybody else, we are so critical of ourselves that we naturally find fault everywhere we go. We set such a high bar that we never reach it. By the way, nobody else does either, but we're not thinking about that. So the way to shift that is to start by saying, I accept myself. And that can take a long time. I worked on appreciation. And each night before I went to bed, I forced myself to say, one new thing I appreciate about myself is. And there are bad days I have where I go to bed and I go, there's nothing to appreciate about myself today. And yet you can find something. You know, I smiled at a stranger. I helped somebody do something. I felt good for most of the morning, whatever it is. I was nice to my kid today. I didn't yell at my children. Appreciate ourselves. we begin to appreciate everybody around us without even thinking about it, because we're retraining our brain. And when you do that, connecting becomes so easy, so obvious. And the trick for women is to take our ability to build really deep, good relationships and then do it in a group, so we get the whole group working towards the vision that we have, the impact we want to have. That is more powerful than the male version of leadership, which is to be the smartest guy and tell everybody else what to do. We can really move mountains. So that's connecting.
And then, moving mountains, you have engaging as your next characteristic. So what's that about?
Engaging is where the rubber meets the road. You have to act. But we often don't. We often don't act because we're afraid. And it's so interesting. This woman called me today. She's the COO of a bank. Out of nowhere, she said, I just want to talk to you. And I was in the car. So I thought, okay, let's chat. Janet is her name. And Janet said, I'm not afraid. I really don't like it when all these women talk about being afraid, because I'm not afraid of anything. I said, that's great. Let's talk about your questions for me. And she said, well, you know, this happened like 30 years ago, and I really wanted to ask your opinion about it. I was working on a team at a consulting firm, and I was having dinner with the partner and the client and everybody. And it was late. We were at a bar. And the partner came up, and he started to massage my shoulders. And I didn't like it. But I didn't say anything because I didn't want to lose my job. And I said to her, gee, Janet, that happened, how long ago that happened? 30 years ago. I said, it's still resonating for you, right? She said, yes, I can really feel it. I'm really angry. I said, well, guess what? You're afraid. You just got triggered again about the same incident. So get curious about yourself. And what is it that made you afraid? And she said, losing all my power. And we talked about it. She said, oh my God, I just never thought about it this way. You're right. I'm still afraid. Because, of course, she's COO of a bank. It's like, you're afraid of losing your job? Are you kidding me? You're a very powerful person. And that is something for us all to ponder. How do you get over that fear? It never goes away. So the way you do it is to listen to another voice. So how many people have a little voice in their head that sort of, okay, is it your mother? Yeah, because that was mine until I gave her name. The voice I have in my head is my critic, right? Your voice usually warns you, tells you you're stupid, tells you not to do something. Don't speak up. People will laugh at you. Don't dress differently. People won't like it. They won't like you. Well, whatever she's saying to you. The other voice is the voice, call it the voice of hope, the voice of your vision, the voice of your coach, the voice of the wise man or wise woman that you carry with you. Any of those will do. And hear that voice too. You can't tell the other one to shut up because it doesn't work. But you can listen to a second voice and you be the one who synthesizes, who integrates. That's what I began to do. And I chose Ralph Waldo Emerson because my kids were going through the ninth grade and we had to read a lot of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he's a dreamer. He's a visionary from the 1800s who's unbelievable, who helped me understand that I want to create a path that no one's ever been on. My path is to help women all over the world. That's what I do now. I totally have hope, and my fear of being silly or humiliated in front of people, I don't care anymore.
And last comes energizing. So what, as part of this energizing characteristic, we'd also be interested in your take on work-life balance.
Yeah. So who here has work-life balance? Okay. You may have it. You were the only one. And you only raised your hand halfway. All these people told me, forget about it. Particularly if you're in a stressful job, particularly if you want to get stuff done and you have a family and you have other people in your life you care about and you like to cook or do whatever you like to do. This is a lot of living. Women, on average, want more out of life than men because we think about it not compartmentally but holistically. So it's not going to work to try to get work-life balance. What will work is understanding your energy. Where does it come from? Where does it go? What drains you? And when is it time to fill back up? So for me, the big insight was to realize that at work, in the morning and in the afternoon, I needed to give myself permission to recover. It takes 10 minutes or less to do that. You're basically putting yourself into a low positive energy state. If you do mindfulness practice, you can do that. If you are a spiritual person, you could read poetry or read your own religious testaments, or just look out the window and think good thoughts, or listen to beautiful music. If you're emotional, and that's where you get your energy from, talk to a friend, call somebody you love, walk down the hallway, see a colleague, and just appreciate them. It'll make you feel fantastic. Tell somebody you're grateful. If you're a mentally charged person, why then go learn something. Go figure something new out. Go find out what other people are working on. That's going to excite you. And if you're a physical person, why then go run up a bunch of stairs and walk down them and think about your intention for the rest of the day, and you will have recovery legally at work for under 10 minutes. This thing is fail-safe. I kid you not.
What is one practice that you use that we could all benefit from doing?
Who here wakes up in the morning and the first thing you do is look at email? On your iPhone, your Android, your BlackBerry? Okay, so half the group is honest and agreeing that they do this. If you don't do it, you have a gift. So for those of us who do it, the practice is to not do it. The practice is to wake up before your dog needs to go out, before your kid starts to scream, etc. Unless you're a voluntary fireman or an ER doctor or nurse, you can do this. Just wake up and have a few deep breaths in and exhaling. And ask yourself this question. What do I want for and from myself today? You might say, I just want to be calm. I thought yesterday, I was teaching a bunch of women in IT from around the world, that I wanted to be kind, because I knew that if they were passive, I might get aggressive, and I didn't want to be aggressive with them or with myself. And in fact, it worked well, because I reminded myself of my intention at 10 in the morning. At night, before you go to bed, practice gratitude and just ask yourself, what's one new thing I'm grateful for today? Or if you're working on appreciation and acceptance, use that one. If you have kids who talk, you can ask your kids, what are three good things that happened to you today? And what's one not so good thing that happened to you today? So if you bookend your day just with those questions, you will find so much more energy. You will be so much more alert and engaged and present in your day to everybody around you. It will be phenomenal. They'll just say, I feel like a new woman. Instead of taking all of the problems that people are emailing you whenever you wake up at 5, 6, 7, or 8. You're right? Because nobody is sending you love letters first thing in the morning.
So, Joanna, you've been on a journey. You've made discoveries along the way. Can you share with us where you are in your journey right now?
I am really excited about something. I thought, gee, it will be over. I wrote the second book. Oh, I'm going all around the world. I've been to Saudi Arabia this year to fight for women's rights, and it was quite stunning to meet these Saudi Arabian women who drive when they're not allowed to drive, who run businesses that they run out of Dubai because they're not allowed to incorporate them in Saudi Arabia, and on. The courage that women have is amazing. I am now gestating a new book for younger women, and it's really good for all women, but it's particularly good for your daughter and your daughter's friend Rosie and women 20 to 30. There you are. There they are, right there. Lee. That's Lee. She's a nurse practitioner. So the book is about your 50 first steps. Once you are leaving school, whenever that is, and you are moving into the world, and the world is so big and confusing, and most women say, oh my God, I don't want to take the wrong step. There is no such thing as the wrong step. But why not take it with consciousness, with alertness, with joy, with excitement for learning? Imagine how that would look like. And so you don't have to wait till you're 32 to say, now I can really begin my life. So that's what I'm working on now. I'm really excited about it.
Now I have one more question for you.
To have disconnected. There we go. I have one more question for you, and I'm giving the audience a heads up that after that we're going to take questions from the audience. So what kind of leader are you now versus when you started out 10 years ago?
Yeah. You know, 10 years ago, my mother called me up. She's passed away, but at the time she was obviously alive and kicking. And she said, Joe, I need to tell you this. I don't like you anymore. It was actually, she did me a favor. I had been a senior partner at McKinsey. I wore all black for me to look more grown up and act more mature. I wore very high heels because I am under 5 feet tall. And I tried not to laugh, and I really suppressed everything about me. And I worked so hard at that that I actually didn't like myself either. And I just went through a journey to say, well, who am I? I mean, you think you'd know that at 50, right? You'd think you'd know it. But I didn't really know it. I didn't know what my strengths were. I thought my strength was leadership. And it turns out my top strength is industriousness and perseverance. Like, how glamorous is that? I am really good at washing dishes. Every night, I love to do it. Actually, I don't have any fingerprints. They told me I could be a criminal because I wash so many dishes. So in this journey, a couple of things happened to me. One, that discovery that we're not missing anything. We have power in us as well as vulnerability. We have masculine and feminine traits in us, and we can use them both to lead. There is no such thing as the formula of who we need to be successful. We live into our strengths, and that's what I began to do. And the funny thing is, you know what? I didn't get a leadership position at McKinsey. They didn't give me one for whatever reason. But centered leadership, which we started to really invent in 2007, took hold. And hundreds upon hundreds of people at McKinsey who don't even know who I am know my name and centered leadership and tell me that their lives are changing because of this. So now I face fear. I am still afraid of everything, but I face it with curiosity. I use my emotion. I use my humor because it's who I am. I used to be afraid of connecting with people because I thought everybody was out to hurt me. And we could talk about that for another hour, but we don't have time. I now start with the conscious assumption that people want to help me. And that changes how I give. It changes how I trust. I felt that way about you today. It's just amazing how my life is changing. So the best part of it is not what I do at work. I did make it to the finish line at McKinsey. I'm the first woman to hit 60 and still be alive. And I retire. I now have the energy of a 20-year-old. I now have the resilience of, you know, 10 warriors. I will go anywhere and talk to anybody about anything. I was hanging out with Eric Schmidt, the guy who's the chairman of Google, and I said to him, I think you're all wrong about how women use their smartphones. I'm like, how could I say that? I don't even have a fact to stand on. And I just said, I want to have a conversation with you about that. Cool. I want to tell you the best moment of my month
was I was going to give a speech at Google, which I did give, and I was sitting next to this tall African-American man who's very good-looking and much younger than me, and I was watching the person speaking, and I was getting really, really nervous and afraid. And I turned to him, and I said, I looked at his name tag, and I said, Sean, I'm really nervous. They're going to kill me when I go up there. Sean Combs, P. Diddy, said, nice to meet you. Like, I'm a little old lady. What do I know? And he said, Joanna, as he's reading my name, I can already tell that you're more interesting than that guy up there.
Well, I agree with him. And now, if people in the audience would have a question, please walk up to one of the mics. Joanna would love to hear from you.
They're all leaving. Oh, my God, I'm spiraling down.
Yeah. Why don't we start over there?
I hope it's on. I don't know.
Just try to talk into it, and if not, we'll speak very loudly.
Okay. It often goes sort of swept under the rug or unnoticed, or you don't get leadership credit in your organization. This is my experience. What is your view of the role of mentorship in leadership or in your leadership model?
So there is a difference between mentorship and sponsorship, and I'm not sure if you're talking about sponsorship. Sponsorship is the key to helping future leaders grow and become leaders. Mentorship is what we all do as good citizens. Think of a mentor as Yoda. Yoda, you know Yoda, right, from Star Wars. Yoda has given us the best advice anybody has ever given anybody. You know what it is? Do, is it? You're going to say it? If anybody could say it in Yoda's voice, $1. Do or do not. There is no try. Sponsorship, which is what I think you're talking about, is when you stick your neck out, you create opportunities for other people, and you help them succeed. That must be valued by the top team. They themselves must do it. And if they're not, their company ultimately will decline in health. Because that's a very healthy model, to spot the talented people behind you and help them grow. It doesn't mean you cover up for them. You don't. You help them learn from mistakes, and you believe in them enough so that they have the courage to try new things. That is really important, and it's an integral part of connecting.
Could we go over here, please?
Yes. So, really loved your presentation today. We also love your shoes.
They're amazing. Yeah.
And we really love your energy. I'm particularly impressed with how you've reinvented yourself, and it's just very encouraging. I've heard lots of comments today about life after 50, so nearing that, I'm very excited about that. My question is, how has your internal dialogue changed as you've grown into this space and this kind of next version of you? We've heard a lot of talks about that today in the general sessions and the breakout sessions, so it's great to hear that reaffirmed by you. But just curious as to what you're saying to yourself and how you're kind of keeping yourself up.
You know, it's really interesting. I started with the critic, and around the time my mom died, which was 4 years ago, I really started to fall apart. And I got help from a coach who had worked with me over the years, and I had the need to have these voices in me be heard. This sounds a little goofy. Okay, so for those of you who say, I'm now uncomfortable, don't worry, the story has a good ending. So this voice of this critic came out really loudly, and the voice of a little girl came out too. And what I realized was when my mother died that I had no protector in me, no mother in me, and I needed to invent a mother to take care of myself when I needed to be taken care of. But the epiphany that I had was the critic literally, right out of my mouth, started to say, I am working 24/7 to take care of Joanna, and she is screwing up all over the place. I have not had a vacation for 3 years. That's what she said. So you know what I did? I honored her, the critic, and I said, thank you for trying to keep me out of trouble. I bought her some jewelry. This is what I bought her. And she quieted down. I actually gave her a name because I can be so mean. I have such a sharp tongue that sometimes it, particularly when I'm tired, so I gave her a name. Does anybody know the movie The Incredibles?
Yes.
Edna? Do I look like Edna? So I, my daughters now say, Edna, get back in there. When I say mean things, that's who she is. So now that I've made peace with Edna, I can hear the voice of my mother. I can hear, not my real mother, the mother I invented to help me. I can hear the voice of my visionary. I can hear my little girl. I can hear all the voices. And the point is they all live in all of us. You just have to listen.
Okay, could we go back there and then, yes, and then I think I apologize for this, but after that I believe I'm getting the hook here. We will have time for one more question. I apologize, but Joanna, would you stay afterwards since we have
sure.
more questions than time available?
And I'll try to talk fast.
Okay.
So I would start with yourself. And this sounds trite, but the only person you can change is yourself. And not that there's anything wrong with you. There is nothing wrong with you. But if you start, ask yourself, why is this triggering me? What in me is being triggered right now? As I think about these people, And it may well be that you have a need deep down that's not being met. And it may be recognition. A lot of us have that. We want to be seen and heard, and we're not. When you sit with these other people, and I would sit with them one by one, I would ask them two questions. One is, what do I do that inspires your trust? And the second is, what could I do? Not that I will, but what could I do more of or new to inspire your greater trust, and hear what it is they want for you. If it's different from what you feel you deserve, as we saw in the Microsoft example, then you have to learn to use what Marshall Rosenberg calls nonviolent communications. And actually what it is the ability to say what you feel and what you would like. So without passion or emotion, to be able to say, I feel unrecognized for what I've accomplished. And what I would like is to have you see it and let me know if you value it, tell me, and if you don't value it, tell me why. That would be, you deserve that. But it is, how do you feel and what would you like? That is where you start, without blame. So you have to let go of what's wrong with these people, because that's blame.
Let's try one more question, and then I do want to say that Joanna has agreed to come to PPL's booth, which is number 635, if that helps you navigate how to get there, in Exhibit Hall B, for a meet and greet for the next hour, so then she can speak more to each of you. But could you please go forward?
Yeah.
I apologize.
Amazing talk, really inspiring. I love that you've traveled to the Middle East. I work and live in the Middle East full time, and I work with a lot of female entrepreneurs there. And one thing that we love to do is interview these entrepreneurs and ask them what's inspired them, what's pushed them, what struggles have they faced. But I would like to know from your experience, what is the best question that you've ever been able to ask a woman anywhere in the world during your interviews? And B, what's the best answer you got?
I love, for a long time, I loved asking the question, when you're 80 and sitting on your rocker, what will you think back on and really enjoy remembering? And after a while, I got the same answer from everybody, and then I realized this is an eternal truth. What people told me was, I will remember the people I love the most, and that the only thing that matters in the end is love and your family, if your family is a positive relationship for you, or your friends. And to me, that was just like, whoa, nobody's thinking about work. So then I had to ask more deeply. And what I began to enjoy asking is, when you hit a low point in your career, how did you recover? And this one woman, Margaret Jackson, was the chairman of Qantas Airline. And she was the chairman when 9/11 struck, and there were Australians stuck all over the world and all over Australia, and they all wanted to get back home, and, you know, her airline wasn't operating like everybody else's wasn't operating. And she said there was so much stress that she had in her from trying to run this airline that one day she went home and saw the plum tree on her front lawn and decided that it needed to be pruned. And she said, I have never pruned a plum tree. She got out these giant scissors, whatever they're called, secateurs, and she got up on a ladder and she started to cut at this tree until two-thirds of it were on the ground. And her husband had driven up and he said to her, what are you doing? And she said she had so much tension, it was just a great release. And that she brought that story to her management team. And it turned out they were all doing ridiculous things. One guy decided that the tree on the left side of the driveway should be on the right side, so he moved it. And that common acceptance that we're afraid and it's okay to be afraid really, really helped me understand how you recover. To me, recovery is even more powerful than what's your high point.
Well, thank you, and I'm sorry we cannot go on.
Thank you. Thank you.